everyone. This is Al Goetz with the August 2024 edition of the Charting the Territories podcast, where we go back in time to take a look at pro wrestling in the territorial era. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, John Boucher. John, how are you this hot August night?
Oh, it is hot. What is the temperature near you?
It was hot today. I was at the Braves game. They had a day game earlier today. It was, I think it was 90. I think that's all it got to, which is cooler than it has been the last few days. I survived. The Braves did not. The Braves lost 7-0 to the Miami Marlins today.
Ooh.
So, but the Mets lost too. So at least they didn't gain any ground on us, but the Phillies won. So they extended their lead in the division. But we're not here to talk about the National League East.
No.
In fact, we're going to talk about a place that is as geographically far away as you can be from the National League East while still being in the United States.
Sure.
And that is the 50th state of Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And we're going to look at 50th state big time in 1971. We're going to look at the roster, the biggest feuds, the towns we know they ran house shows in, and where else they might have run. We'll also look at the life and wrestling career of Ricky Hunter, plus talk a little bit about Rick Rinaldo, someone we've talked about in the past. We'll also discuss the Tregos Thez Hall of Fame induction weekend that took place in July in Waterloo, Iowa. As we always do, we'll post a lot of content to Twitter related to what we discuss on the podcast, and I'll use the hashtag CTTAUG24. Of course, we're going to have all our regular features, including John Plays Gordon Solie's Championship Wrestling Trivia. This month, I learned, and we kick things off with stuff John bought me off eBay. So we almost had a first in podcast history. As our listeners know, John is authorized to spend up to $50 ordering me stuff off of eBay and sending it directly to me. And usually it comes in a week or so before the podcast. But this time we cut it a little bit close. I actually got this item 24 hours before we are recording it.
Oh boy.
So came down to the wire and let's see what it is. It looks to be programs of some sort. Oh no. Okay. Oh, it looks like somebody cut out the original newspaper clippings and then attach them to a typewritten sheet with the results.
Yes.
And these are from, let's see, November 1968. And then there is also a program. So it's two newspaper clippings with a separate typed out piece of paper with the results. And then there is one newspaper clipping by itself, and this is from the original newspaper, and it's held up pretty good if it's considering it's probably about 50 years old. On this one, the main event was Ray Stevens versus Jim Hady, also Bull Iaquea versus Peter Maivia, Pedro Morales versus Pat Patterson, I guess Magnificent Maurice versus Missing Link, who here was Pamparo Furpo, Killer Carl Cox versus Billy White Wolf, Ripper Collins versus Neff Maiava, and some others. The 1968 matches included Giant Baba versus Johnny Barrett. Is it Barrand or Berend?
I've heard it both ways.
Okay. Well, then I don't feel so bad if I got it wrong. Also, Nick Bockwinkle versus Mr. X. Not sure who Mr. X was in 1968. But then another one is Baba teaming up with Bockwinkle against Ripper Collins and Crazy Luke Graham, plus Johnny Barrand versus Red Bastine. And the program is from March of 1979. So much later. And on the cover is Armando Guerrero.
Don't look at the back cover.
Don't look at the back cover. Oh, no. It is someone who is canceled.
Oh, yeah.
And that is Buck Rock and Roll Zumhoff. And on the bottom, there's a little caption that says, Buck Rock and Roll Zumhoff may like to dance with the ladies, but he is also ready to fight any and all opponents in the ring. I think we need to change that but and come up with something else to say He may like to dance with the ladies, but
yeah.
And listeners, fill in the blank yourselves. Well, what's interesting is this program from 1979 does have a little calendar of events over a 18-day period of time, where they ran 9 shows in those 18 days.
Huh.
So there's March 21st, 1979, at the Neil Blaisdell Center, which was their primary venue at that time, I think. And then Molokai High. I hope they didn't serve cocktails there. Molotov cocktails. a show at a venue called the Conroy Bowl. And then the Block Arena. Now, between the Blaisdell and the Block, I think one of those was at Pearl Harbor, and the other was in Honolulu, but I could be very wrong. March 31st, they ran Hilo, Hawaii. April 1st, they ran Maui. Then they were back to the Block Arena on the 4th. And so it looks like they alternated. It looks like they alternated between the Blaisdell Center or the Block Arena on the same day of the week, because they ran it on March 21st, March 28th, and April 4th.
Huh.
And these are the types of things that I notice probably more than most people, because so many territories run a weekly loop. So I look to see if they ran the same venue, the same calendar day. So yeah, this is pretty cool. There's also a Russian here by the name of Ivan Markov.
Ooh.
And I'm not sure who that is. Yeah, I'm not well versed on late 70s Hawaii, because they had a lot of, so not necessarily local stars, but here's Brian Blair. Newcomer to Hawaii, Tor Kamada and Ripper Collins, who were veterans of Hawaii by 1979. Also Bill Francis, Don Morocco, Whipper Watson, who I'm assuming is junior, Phil Watson. So as has often been the case, John got me an item related to the topic of this month's podcast. And I'm assuming this was by Grand Design.
Yes. Yes, 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 sir.
Thank you for that. And again, each and every month, John is authorized to spend up to $50 of my money for stuff John bought me off eBay. If our listeners have any suggestions on what John can buy me, you can always reach out to him on Twitter at JON_BOUCHER.
Perfect, yes.
Before we get into Hawaii, there were a few wrestlers who were active in the early 70s that have passed away since our last podcast. Pistol Pete Sanchez, who is probably best known for his appearances in the WWWF, but also had a push as Gino Caruso for Stampede, I believe, in 1971. John, any other memories or tales about Pete Sanchez you want to share?
Those were like my two big notes as well. Like most people our age from our neck of the woods know him as the trusty underneath guy teaming with Manny Soto, but he's one of those guys had a career going back to the late 50s, teaming with Miguel Perez working against the Fargos.
Yeah, was a pushed guy for much of that time, as opposed to what we thought of him, seeing him in the mid 70s and beyond.
And the feud with Abdul the Butcher and Stampede in the early 70s, it's interesting to dig into his career and find out about that stuff. Pete Sanchez is exactly the kind of guy that I think we both enjoy talking about on this show, and maybe we will in more detail in the future.
Yeah, I wish we could talk about all of them. One of our followers actually just reached out on Twitter and was hoping to learn more about Bill White. And yes, that's a guy I would love to spend a whole podcast or a good chunk of a podcast on, but he's one of a couple hundred.
Yeah.
And we just can't get to everybody. And then, of course, with a lot of them, there's really not a whole lot out there aside from what we can say about their wrestling careers. And it's a delicate balance of trying to find people that are interesting to talk about, that have something more than just here's where they wrestled, here's what title they held, here's who they feuded with. But as you mentioned with Sanchez, when Abdullah was presented as an unbeatable monster in Stampede in 70 and 71, Caruso was one of the guys that was programmed against him.
Yeah.
So, just the fact that he was positioned and was able to be viewed by fans as being able to hold his own against Abdullah gives you an idea of how solid his work was in the ring and how well fans took to him. also lost somebody we talked about just a couple of months ago, where we had said that as far as we knew, he was still alive, and he was at the time. Unfortunately, in the last month, he has passed away, and that is Larry Pitchford, aka Beauregard.
We just was it May we just talked about him? Yeah, just a
Yeah,
couple months ago.
I think it was maybe even June. It was within the last
Yeah.
few months for sure. A guy who was ahead of his time in many ways, and also had a very brief wrestling career where he got over really well and had really good roles in Hawaii and in the Pacific Northwest. When he went to, I believe it was Northern California, he didn't move, he didn't advance as high up the cards as we would have expected. Not sure if it was due to his work or other reasons. And then he ends up going to work for Crockett. And at first, he's working as a wrestler, and it seems like he's in line for a push. But then, out of nowhere, he becomes a manager for the team of Jay York and Brute Bernard. And that, by and large, aside from some part-time stuff for Florida a few years later, was the end of his, full-time run as a pro wrestler. So his star shone bright, if not for long.
Yeah, exactly.
Another guy who had a very long career, who also passed away, is Leo Burke, who is also a member of a very, very highly regarded wrestling family, the Cormier family, from Canada. And Leo was probably the one most known, again, as you mentioned earlier, John, to folks our age, because I think his career lasted the longest into the 80s. I think there was some footage or clips of him versus Bret Hart. That might have been from Mid-Atlantic, perhaps when they were in Toronto, that I seem to recall. So, Burke was one of those that had a long career, mostly in Canada, but was a top guy. Of course, his family owned the territory in Canada, so they always had a home base to work out of. But they would winter in the South. I guess when things got way too cold in Canada, they would come down, and you can usually find them either in Central States or Crockett or Amarillo for the first 3 or 4 months of every year from like the mid-60s through the mid-70s. And then when spring sprung, they would go back up to Canada and open up their territory.
Yeah, I think he was the last living of the Cormier brothers. If I think of all, I think there's four wrestlers and one that was a referee, but I think he was the last of them. It's like you mentioned Bret Hart. It's like when you have Bret Hart consistently over the years referring to you as one of the best in-ring workers he's ever been in the ring with. That's really something to you can hang your hat on when Bret Hart says that about you. And Bret posts a really nice, like really sweet, touching tribute to him on social media after he passed, and had a fun little tidbit. He mentioned that like the finish from SummerSlam 92, where the British Bulldog foils Bret's sunset flip and gets the pin there, is a that was a Leo Burke finish that Bret took from him, and him and Leo did that finish around the horn. The crowd always loved it, so he pitched it to Bulldog for SummerSlam 92.
And that's the great thing about wrestling for a long period of time. You sometimes just remember things that work really well. A lot of wrestlers always have things that they were taught, and Bret was probably taught that by Leo at some time and obviously remembered how well it worked. A fourth wrestler who doesn't get talked about as much as the others, but he passed away since our last episode as well. His real name was Alberto Amessa, and he wrestled as Indio Pampero in a few places. And he also wrestled for Crockett in the early mid 70s as Tony Romano. So that's another wrestler who passed away. And in Waterloo, Iowa, we came really close to losing you, John Boucher. So John came to Waterloo, Iowa, along with me. We met up there for the Tregosthez Hall of Fame induction weekend. And John ended up, we all ended up going to the hotel bar slash restaurant after the first night. We were in a group with former Melby Award winners Steven Johnson and Tom Burke, as well as my good friend Bo James, as well as a couple of indie wrestlers that traveled with Bo, Murphy Costigan, and a guy named Matt, who I believe wrestles as Shane Matthews. So we had some drinks and we were telling some stories, and I decided to call it an early night. And John stayed with Bo and his friends. And at some point late the next morning, I get a call from Bo. Have you talked to John? And I said, no, I'm like, we called his room, we knocked on his door, and he's not answering. We think he might be dead.
I was
John
just
was not dead, but
sleeping.
apparently he just needed a little extra time to recover from the festivities the night before.
Yes.
I'll
Yeah.
say this: if you've never hung out, gone out drinking with the boys after a pro wrestling event, even if you think you can drink a lot, somehow, some way, it just seems to hit differently. And I'm guessing that's what happened to John. And then, of course, a couple of days later, as I was coming back from the museum and hoping to catch a cat nap, I saw John and Bo and Murphy and Shane on their way to brunch, and they said, "No, we're going to have mimosas. Come over with us."
Boy, did we have
And
mimosas.
5 hours later, after mimosas at the brunch place and then to another bar, after the mimosa place closed, I was not walking straight as I had to get to the wrestling show that night. What was cool is as we were sitting at the bar, I ended up sitting next to Kurt Hennig's widow and one of her and one of their sons, Hank, was there. Just they randomly happened to be at the same bar we were, so I got to talk to them. We all talked to them for a little bit. But then the very last night, John's close calls with death were not over yet. Because the morning after everything was all done, I texted John, to say goodbye and good luck catching his flight because my flight got canceled. But John texted me back saying, "I have no idea how I got back to my room, and there's a deep dish pizza in bed with me."
Yes, it was delicious too.
All right. Have you talked to Bo since then, John? Because do you know where we think the deep dish pizza came from?
Yes, it was. I sort of pieced together what happened. Yeah, I think I left after we left. Kurt Hennig's widow at one bar. One of the guys and I went to another bar.
Of course you did.
At which point, I decided I needed to get something to eat. I was hungry. So I didn't have that. The brunch part of brunch was not the big part. The mimosas was the big part of the brunch. I got a little half size something. I don't remember what I got because we were initially planning to go out for an early dinner, if you remember. So I was
But the
saving
drinking
room.
got in the way of that.
Drinking out of the way. So I went to that pizza place that was right across from the hotel, the New York slash Chicago style pizza place.
Okay.
Yeah,
All right.
it's pretty good.
That's not where I heard the pizza came from, but who knows? I heard it might have been retrieved from a dumpster late at night.
No, absolutely not. I've a credit card receipt to prove
All right. Well, there you, all right. If you've got proof, that's good enough for me.
I'll do. I'll scan it and hashtag it.
No, you don't need.
CPP August.
All shenanigans aside, though, I do want to say I had an incredible, wonderful time at the Hall of Fame induction weekend. Of course, I received the Jim Melby Award for 2024 for my work as an author and as an historian. And it wasn't until when we were there for the banquet that I really felt like I belonged there and that I deserved it. As I said in my speech, I've been doing this for a much shorter period of time than everyone that had won the award prior to me. Heck, I think Tom Burke has been a wrestling historian for longer than I have been alive. So, I felt like I'm the new kid on the block. Do I really belong here? But in talking with Tom and Steven and everybody else that weekend, it finally made me feel that I did deserve it. And my speech was probably the most unique speech ever given by a Melby Award winner.
I'd have to, without even hearing them, I would have to agree with you,
Yeah,
yes.
usually those are the popcorn match of a wrestling show, but I think I injected a little fun into the speech.
Oh,
Bo
yeah.
did send me, I guess Murphy Costigan was filming it on his phone. I think we have a copy of the whole shebang. I will check it out, and if it looks good, I may very well post it on our YouTube channel. So be
Cool.
sure to check us out on YouTube and Charting the Territories. I do want to say there was also some trash talking going on the part of Chad Olsen. Chad, of course, the only person to have defeated John at Gordon Solie's Championship Wrestling Trivia. And the first night at the bar, Chad was really rubbing it in, John.
He's rubbing a lot of things in.
Yes, he was invading John's personal space and harassing him and trash talking him. And all I have to say is I control which cards we use. I control the hints that are given, and
You
I control the bonus question.
do, yeah.
So Chad, if John is able to build up a nice little streak, he will be getting a rematch, and I don't think either John or I are going to forget how you behaved in Waterloo, Iowa. But I do want to thank Chad
Yes.
for his hospitality all weekend. He also took John and I to the former President Hotel,
Oh,
which was
yeah.
where the National Wrestling Alliance was legitimately formed
Yeah.
in the mid-1940s, the famous hotel in Waterloo, Iowa. Also, everyone on the board, which included Troy Peterson, Gerald Briscoe, Gloria Lovell, Conrad Thompson, and James Beard. I got to meet all of them, save for Conrad, who wasn't able to make it this year. And all of them were really just great, and again made me feel good about this. One morning, I went down to the hotel buffet for breakfast, and I was looking for who I was going to sit with. And Gerald Briscoe walks up and says, "Al, come eat with me, please."
Oh.
So talk about how cool that is that
Yeah.
Gerald Briscoe asked me to sit with him for breakfast one day. That is pretty cool. We also went to the Field of Dreams site, which was an hour away. So we had a great time. But John, what were your other good memories about that weekend?
I mean, it's so much fun just to hang out, like you said, the first night, hanging out with guys like Tom Burke and Steven Johnson, and just being able to pick their brains about
Yeah.
whatever you want, basically. That
Just like
was.
a rookie sitting in the car on the way back and listening to the veterans.
Yeah.
In a way, that's what John and I were able to do this weekend was that weekend was sit under the learning tree of Steven Johnson and Don Burke.
Fantastic. And it was great. Like, again, thank you for letting me giving me over hanging handing me over to Bo to let me hang out with Bo James and those cats. I didn't never met them before, and they were basically, Al said you're all right, so you're all right with us. So that speaks volumes about how they look at you, that you're able to just give the thumbs up for me, and they'll take me in, let me in their room, let me drink their beer, and
Yep.
so thank you
It
for that.
reminds me of something Les Thatcher once said about Brian Hildebrand. Of course, Brian Hildebrand, former WCW referee Mark Curtis, who passed away from cancer over 25 years ago, at this point, about 25 years ago. But Bo and I were actually on the show they did in Western Pennsylvania to raise money for him to help pay his bills. That was the only time that WCW, WWF, and ECW all had talent work in the same show until I think one of the Pillmans a few years later. But what Les said was if you met somebody and you were a friend of Brian Hildebrand's and they were a friend of Brian Hildebrand's, that was all the vetting that was needed. And I think what's interesting about me, and I said this in my speech, Bo and I should not be friends based on our backgrounds or where we came from. Aside from wrestling, we should not be friends in any way, shape, or form. But somehow, some way, we've been friends now for, gosh, going close to 30 years,
Wow, man.
closer to 30 than to 20. And I think closer to 30 than 25. And if somebody's cool with Bo, they're cool with me and vice versa. So that's one of the unique things about the Brotherhood of Professional Wrestling is that you have
Really
people
is.
from all sorts of places, but at the very least, they have that one common bond that right off the bat lets you know you've at least got something in common with this person.
It's wonderful.
So from Waterloo to Honolulu, let's talk about Hawaii in 1971. Every month, I put together a document called A Year in the Life, and I put it up on our website at chartingtheterritories.com. It's available to view in your browser, or you can download it as a PDF for free. There's also a territory fact sheet, which has some pretty neat data points and stats and factoids all laid out on just one, one 8.5 by 11 size sheet of paper. So, John, this month the territory fact sheet was on Hawaii in 1971. Was there anything interesting on that fact sheet that stood out to you?
The first thing that jumped out to me was the estimated completedness of 40 to 85%. I mean, this is a much wider range than what we're used to, or what I'm used to
Right.
looking at.
Right. What I do is I tally up the number of what I call documented house shows that we have for the territory. And based on what else I know about the territory, as well as territories in general, try and pinpoint how complete it is. And usually, as you mentioned, the range is much tighter. It's within 10 or even, 15, 20%. But this one, just because we really don't know how many shows they ran each and every week, it's hard to say how complete this is. But we only have records for 61 house shows in 1971. And that is a show pretty much every week in Honolulu. And then shows not once every 6 or so weeks in Hilo, Hawaii, and then two or three other spot shows. When you look at Hawaii, first, the fact that it's several different islands, it would be very hard to run shows on all the islands because you literally would have to fly the crew each and every night. And when they ran Hilo, which is on a separate island from Honolulu, they almost certainly they flew the crew in. And there's no other town on that island that would be big enough to have regular wrestling. They might have had a spot show every now and then, and they flew the crew in a day early, worked the spot show, stayed over, worked Hilo, then flew back. But I think most of the time they're just doing a day trip. They fly out in the afternoon, work Hilo, stay over, or maybe if it's on a private plane, they can just take the plane back, on a red eye. On Honolulu, on the island where Honolulu is by and large the largest city, but the other largest locales are all suburbs of Honolulu. So I can't see them running them regularly, like a weekly or even every few weeks. They did run Schofield Barracks once during the year. It wouldn't surprise me to learn that they ran that more often. That, of course, is a military base where all the troops stayed. So it seems a natural place to have pro wrestling. And one of the towns with a population of over 10,000 is literally right next to Schofield Barracks. So it could have been a place where they had a show a few times a year, and it would be a night out for the troops where they would get leave and go, a couple streets over to where the wrestling was at. But we just don't know for a fact. So as John pointed out, the estimated completeness, I estimate it's between 40 and 85% complete, whether they ran, two shows a week or five shows a week. That's sort of what I'm using it to estimate. The thing that stood out to me were the wins and losses. What we do for every territory is we break down wins and losses both by babyface or heel status and by position on the card. So you can see in the preliminaries who, did babyfaces win more often than heels? In the main events, was that any different? And what I noticed in Hawaii was that up and down the cards, there are more draws than any other territory I've looked at so far. And in these cases, obviously, in the preliminary matches, they are probably time limit draws. And the further up the card you go, it's more likely that they are double disqualifications or no contests, what have you. But overall, 29% of the bouts in Hawaii went to a draw. And that's more than twice the average of the other territories so far. So that's a lot. And in the preliminary bouts, it's even more pronounced. It was over 40%. So almost half the time, the first one or two matches on a card are a time limit draw, which is just interesting to see the booking philosophies of the different territories. Now, is a year a long enough period of time to get a feel for it? Possibly not. In a perfect world, I would be cranking these out for a several year period for all the territories, but I assure you, it takes up a lot of time to do this. Another interesting thing to do in a perfect world would be to see if there are any changes when a new booker takes over a territory. are there changes to how these wins and losses are distributed? But one of the things we found by and large is the babyface is much more likely to have their hand raised at the end of a match than a heel. And this, to some aspect, defies the prevailing wisdom, although the prevailing wisdom wasn't necessarily related to wins and losses. It was related to heat. And because we always believed that the baby faces would get screwed week in, week out until the blow off when they would finally win. And here, even though the baby faces are winning, that doesn't mean they're not, getting screwed. They might be winning by DQ when the heel's eight buddies all jump him and break every bone in his body. Or there might be something going on after the match for the heels to get their heat back to set up, a rematch. But the idea is just, this is a story. You're telling a story, and the idea is to send the fans home happy and have the baby faces hand raised. Even if the heels beat the crap out of him and get DQ'd, still at the end of the night, they'll announce him as the winner. They'll raise his hand and the fans will go, yay. You can see more from the territory fact sheet, as well as everything else that comprises a year in the life at chartingtheterritories.com. But now John and I are going to run down the roster for Hawaii in 1971. And again, as I mentioned last month, I've sort of changed things up. We're now counting tag teams and singles wrestlers separately. So I'll note which tag teams show up regularly, but the ones here are also singles wrestlers. So when we mention a tag team, we won't do any fun facts. We'll just save that for when we talk about the wrestler as a single. So in the main eventer category, and these are wrestlers who have a spot rating of 0.80 or higher, on the babyface side, the highest ranked act was a tag team of Bearcat Wright and Sam Steamboat, and following them was by himself Bearcat Wright.
Yeah, right. Was 8-0 with 5 knockouts as a boxer. Most likely he had quite a few more bouts and possibly wins that we don't have records for, but as of his records, 8-0, 5 knockouts.
His earliest documented wrestling match was in December 1951 when he teamed with Jack Pasek to face Hans Schmidt and Johnny Mucci. John, do you remember what we talked about with Johnny Mucci earlier this year?
No.
He's believed to have been the first POW taken in Japan and the last one released.
Oh, yes.
And he also was alleged to have staged fights between the POWs to distract
Yes.
the guards
Now it's coming back. Yep.
so they could steal food and whatnot, which is wild if true. If
Yes.
true being the presumptive, term. On the heel side, first on the list is Sweet Daddy Siki.
Speaking of the armed services, Sweet Daddy Siki reached the rank of corporal in the U.S. Army.
His most frequently documented tag team partner was Sailor Art Thomas. Actually, seems like an odd team when you know that Siki was typically a flamboyant heel and Art Thomas was more of a straight up babyface. But they teamed up for Capital Sports in 1961 and feuded with the Fabulous Kangaroos. Next up is Gene Kaniski.
From 1958 all the way through 1982, we only have records of Gene Kaniski losing clean in St. Louis on 6 occasions.
Yeah, this was a guy. He had a long run as a respected, believable guy in St. Louis, no matter where he was wrestling. Now, he got his start in wrestling when Arizona promoter Rod Fenton had him and other members of the University of Arizona football team work security at his shows. Next up, while he's ranked behind Gene Kaniski and Sweet Daddy Siki, he is clearly the number one heel in the territory during the year because he was there the whole year, whereas Kaniski was a part-timer and Siki was only there for a few months. But this is Mad Dog Mane, and this was a couple of years before he became Moondog Mane, but this is
Yes.
Lonnie Mane using the name Mad Dog Mane.
As a sophomore, Maine helped Olympus High School in Salt Lake City win their state wrestling championship.
Now, his father, Kenny Mayne, retired from the ring in 1958, but came out of retirement for a one-week run in Portland, which I believe was 69 or 70, that saw him team with Lonnie and Tony Bourne 3 times. So there were at least 3 occasions where Lonnie got to team with his father. Next up is a tag team, and that's Mad Dog Maine teaming with Ripper Collins. And that's how they gave Maine his first push, was by teaming him up with the established veteran on the island, Ripper Collins. In the upper mid-card category, and these are wrestlers with a spot rating between 0.60 and 0.80, spot rating, of course, being the metric we use to measure a wrestler's position on the cards or their spot on the cards. First up on the babyface side is Billy Robinson.
Billy Robinson came from a family of boxers. His father, uncle, and great-grandfather were all boxers, and he was on that path himself before an accident. I think he got hit with like a tin Coca-Cola sign in his eye, which derailed his boxing career.
Now, Billy faced Andre the Giant four times in Japan when Andre was billed as Monster Rusamoff for the IWE promotion. All four matches went to time limit draws.
Wow.
And those are the only singles matches between the two. So Robinson might be one of the few people who could say he faced Andre at least four times and never lost to him.
Wow.
Next up is Sam Steamboat.
Sam Steamboat's real last name, I'm going to butcher it.
Yes.
Mokuahai? Loosely translate to steamboat, or actually more literally, troop ship.
Okay, Sam, troop ship doesn't quite have the same ring
to
it.
No, it doesn't.
Now, Sam's final matches were in 1978, and one of those matches was against Lindy Calder. John, we talked about Lindy last November on the podcast. Do you remember who Lindy's sister once dated?
I do not.
That would be Eric Burden.
Oh, wow.
In fact, it is believed that one of the songs from Eric Burden and the Animals was written about Lindy Calder's sister.
Wow.
Now, on the heel side, someone we mentioned earlier as teaming up with Mad Dog Maine to help kickstart Maine's push, and that is Ripper Collins.
Ripper Collins was born Roy Clone, K-L-O-H-N. I believe it's German, in Oklahoma. And after his mother divorced his father on the grounds of cruelty, rather than take his mother's maiden name, he changed his last name to the more Americanized sounding Collins once he turned 18.
And this brings up an interesting point, because up until now, it was generally believed that Ripper Collins' real name was Roy Lee Alburn, A-L-B-E-R-N.
Yeah.
So, John, do you know anything about this, how that came about?
I don't. I can't find anything about the Alburn. I was looking. I got in a hole, a Ripper Collins hole, a couple days ago. Yeah. You want to kind of stay. You don't want to go too deep in that hole. Trust me. I was looking under all those names, you know, Roy Collins, but nothing, 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 nothing.
Okay.
And somehow I got to this and found like a high school yearbook photo of him. And it's like, once you see that photo, you're like, there, this is absolutely.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt that it's him. So
yeah,
this is interesting. And it's funny, because when you were originally talking about the divorce and that whole situation, I was wondering if you were going to follow up with, so he took his other parents' last, maiden name or last name or whatever, but apparently we'll need to figure out where Alburn came from, and who knows, but we may have learned something new. Now, there was one wrestler in the upper mid-carder category who turned during the year. He started the year as a heel, but late in the year he turned babyface, and that is Curtis Iaquea.
Curtis's grandfather was appointed Secretary of the Hawaiian Territory by President Woodrow Wilson. And
that's
also days,
not that, that when you say territory, you're not talking about wrestling.
No, the actual not the promotion. He was an actual government official. And in those days, where communication was not as instantaneous as it is today, he would actually take on the role of the acting governor of Hawaii when the governor was traveling, you know, from the islands and was incommunicado.
Moving down to the mid-carder category, and these are wrestlers with a spot rating between 0.4 and 0.6 on the babyface side. First up is Eddie Morrow.
Eddie Morrow shares a name with a governor of Kentucky from the early 1920s who championed equal rights for African Americans.
His earliest documented match on WrestlingData.com is against Andre Drapp. So we mentioned Johnny Mucci earlier. Drapp was part of the French Resistance during World War II, and is believed to have killed a couple of Nazis.
Wow.
Saw fighting.
All right.
So again, Big if true.
Yeah, big if true.
Yes. Next up is Dino Lanza, which was the name that Tony Marino used here and in Australia.
In the mid-60s, Tony worked as a special project associate with the Rochester Police Department's Community Service Unit, which specialized in youth outreach and athletic services. At the time, Tony's brother, I think, was a sergeant with the Rochester Police Department, so that was probably his in there.
So did he wear the Batman outfit? Because that would be perfect
That, oh, that'd be
for, community outreach with kids, is to show up as
that's
Batman and talk
yeah,
about the
that's
police.
perfect.
Now, when he wrestled as Batman, and of course he spelled Batman with two T's to avoid a lawsuit, I guess, but his outfits were custom made by Carlin Hildegards of Columbus, Ohio. Carlin Hildegards is probably better known as K&H Wrestling Wear. That was the same company, and I think the name was shortened to K&H several years later. They are perhaps the most prolific maker of pro wrestling gear for literally decades. Next up is Frankie Lane.
Really, Gino Brito claims to have rechristened Frankie Luhovi Frankie Lane. His reason for doing so was simply that Frankie Lane was his favorite singer. And Frankie Lane, for what it's worth, the singer was actually born Francesco Lavecchio. So we've got a bunch of fake Frankie Lanes running around here.
Fake Frankie's. Frankie says, relax.
Yes.
In 1969, Frankie Lane teamed with Danny Little Bear for Leroy McGurk in a rare instance of cowboys and Indians getting along. Now, on the heel side of the mid-carders, first up is someone we'll be talking about a little bit later on the podcast, and that is the Gladiator, who was Ricky Hunter. Next up is Dale Lewis.
Dale Lewis went to Marquette University on two, count them, two athletic scholarships, one for basketball and one for football. Actually, he didn't start wrestling until like later in life after he dropped out and joined the Marines and was able to win a spot as an alternate on the 56 Olympic teams with just 6 months wrestling experience.
Now, his opponents for two of his last three documented matches, talk about going out in style, were Rowdy Roddy Piper and Chris Colt.
Wow.
Next up, another mass wrestler. We talked about the Gladiator earlier, and now we have the professional, who was Doug Gilbert, aka Doug Lindsay.
In 1955, Doug Lindsay won the title of Mr. National High School. The South Bend, Indiana newspaper reported that that title was the eighth that the high school senior had won in his 4 years of daily workouts.
Doug was from, and I may be pronouncing the name of the city wrong, but Mishawaka, Indiana. But he's probably not the most famous person that came from Mishawaka, as it is the same city that actor Adam Driver, who played Kylo Ren in the most recent Star Wars movies, grew up. It was that Driver was actually born in California, but grew up in Mishawaka, Indiana, and went to high school there. And there's apparently a picture of him that was in the local paper when he was in high school, where he was complaining about having to pay 50 cents for a packet of mayonnaise to put on his sandwich for a school lunch. Now,
Does seem excessive.
the final wrestler on in the mid-card section is someone that nobody knew who he was, whether he had an alter ego, whether he was better known under a different name. And that is Bill Steele, who also wrestled, also sometimes billed as the Skull, or sometimes the Skull Bill Steele. However, later on in this podcast, in this month, I will reveal who Bill the Skull Steele actually was. And it is someone much better known under another name.
Oh, wow.
Going to move down to the preliminary wrestlers, and first on the babyface side is a young kid just entering, is probably his sophomore year as a pro, and that is Don Morocco.
Now, Morocco received a football scholarship to the University of Hawaii in 1969, but within a year, apparently plans changed as he began working in the Pacific Northwest as Don Morrow.
Now, I always find it funny thinking about ECW before it was Extreme. Back when it was Eastern Championship Wrestling, they had a much different look to their crew and to their shows. As a matter of fact, Don Morocco was probably at that time was probably like the most like hard-hitting member of the roster. But before it was Extreme, Eastern Championship Wrestling featured Don Morocco feuding with guys like Jimmy Snuka and Tito Santana, among others. Just amazing to see what that promotion turned into. Next up is a wrestler who first came in under a mask and then was unmasked and stayed under a different name. And this was the same thing he did in Portland earlier in the year, and that is the Avenger, aka Han Lee.
He's credited with being the trainer of both El Canek and Viano 3.
That's a pretty good record right there for training guys. Han Lee was born in Guanajuato, Mexico, a city known for its network of incredibly narrow streets, including one called the Alley of the Kiss.
Oh my.
And it's so named because the balconies above the alley that were facing one another practically touched one another. So you could be standing in one building and someone else could be standing across the street, across the alley in another building. And from the balconies, you could actually kiss one another without, having to worry about falling. Next up is someone we've touched on a couple of times in the past, and that is Pancho Lopez. And then someone we mentioned earlier, Beauregard.
We talked about him quite a bit back in May, like we said. One of my favorite tidbits that I learned about him then was that before he got the Beauregard name, Neff Maiva and Nick Bockwinkel came up with the name Eric the Golden Boy for him, which I love.
And next up is Duncan McTavish.
He was born in Scotland, and when he was in Scotland, worked as a coal miner in his teens. And then after his family moved to Ontario, quite a different job, he worked for the Lifesavers Candy Company.
Now, in 1964, he worked for Capital Sports as Matt Gilmore. And over the span of about a month, he got in the ring against, listen to this collection of guys he faced: Ernie Ladd, Bill Watts, Bobo Brazil, Bruno Sammartino, Gorilla Monsoon, and Killer Kowalski.
Jesus.
If you didn't learn anything after wrestling all those guys, that there really was going to be nothing for you in pro wrestling. But of course, Duncan's one of those guys because he spent a lot of time in Idaho and Utah, where there just isn't a lot of records. We just don't have a lot about him. But everything I've ever seen about him was that he was really, really good, had a good mind for the business, and also was a pretty decent guy outside the ring. And like I said, I would love to, talk more about Duncan McTavish, but we just don't know much about him other than, his wrestling career and what has been said about wrestlers. There's just really not a lot more to him that we can talk about. I'm sure there are plenty of things in his life that are worth talking about, but we just, because he was born overseas, and because he spent a lot of time in places that just don't get talked about a lot and don't get coverage, we just don't know much about him, which is a shame. On the heel side of the preliminary wrestlers, first up is Masa Fujiwara, who is Harry Fujiwara, aka Mr. Fuji.
Not only was young Harry Fujiwara one of the highest scorers on his junior interscholastic basketball team, he was also a clarinet soloist and was a finalist in a clarinet scholarship competition.
Two things I never thought Mr. Fuji was ever involved in: basketball or the clarinet,
Yeah, I don't know which is more
which is more
jarring to think
shocking.
about.
Yes. Now, he's best known for his tag team title runs with various partners, but he did have four singles title reigns as well, one each in Portland, San Francisco, Puerto Rico, and Toronto. Next up is Fidel Castillo. This was almost certainly Hurricane Castillo of Puerto Rican wrestling fame. He spent a few years in Canada and the mainland US before going to Puerto Rico pretty much for good in the late 70s. Next up is Jack Pesek.
At the time of his death in 1990, I think, his average 41.5 yards per punt was the school record for the Nebraska Cornhuskers. Since then, at least a dozen people have bested that record, though.
Now, Jack spent much of his career working for Joe Dusick in Nebraska, but that came to a sudden end in July 1971. And we talked about this last year on the podcast, but Jack got into a fight with Joe Dusick backstage. And in a letter to Dave Cameron, which we shared at the time, Jack wrote that he punched Joe's head out of shape. Just such a great line.
is.
Next up is Rocky Montero.
He had a big run teaming up with Kurt Von Steiger on the West Coast as the Masked Invaders in the mid-70s, but the two had actually first teamed up, like, I think nearly a decade earlier, working in Mobile, Alabama in the mid-60s.
Now, his most frequent documented opponent was Pedro Morales. They faced one another numerous times in Northern California, first in 1968, and then again in 1975, which was when Rocky was teaming with Von Steiger under a mask. And they were feuding with Pedro and various partners, I think, including Pat Patterson and probably several others. And then finally, on the list of the roster of regular wrestlers in Hawaii in 1971, is someone we've talked about in the past, but we're going to talk a little bit more about him because, John, you found some new, well, some pr articles that we haven't previously talked about. They're from
Yes.
1990 and 1991.
New to
And
me.
this is Rick Rinaldo.
Yeah.
So, the Rick Rinaldo claims to have been an ATF or FBI undercover agent infiltrating white nationalist groups. So, John, talk a little bit about the two are the articles from 1990.
Yeah, they go into a little more detail about his exploits and than what I've personally read before. One of them states that the mid to late 80s, and he's referred to here as Rico Rinaldo Valentino, which I'm guessing is his real name, showed up at the Aryan Nation headquarters in an old pickup truck. He claimed to be a tax protester from Alaska who was on the run from the IRS. He also claimed to be an ex-pro wrestler, which we know is true, who was still making money from promoting matches. Now, Richard Butler, head of the Aryan Nation, mentioned that Valentino always seemed to have like a big pile of money, plenty of money wherever they went. They'd go out to dinner with the wives and the families. Ronaldo would take care of the bill, $400 bill, no problem. Tip the waitress 100, here you go. Always decked out in jewelry, a big diamond ring, bigger ring than he'd ever seen any woman wearing, said Butler, the head of the Aryan Nation. So taken with Valentino and his imposing size and diamond rings was Butler that Valentino became Butler's bodyguard, traveling with him to white supremacy meetings in Tennessee and elsewhere. So this sort of culminates to May of 1990, where Valentino and two other members of the Aryan Nation left their headquarters and they're headed to a Seattle recording studio to record an English version of one of Hitler's World War II Panzer marches. When they were arrested outside a motel in connection with a plot to bomb a gay disco outside Seattle.
Are there any other were there any other kinds of discos back then? And what the, I mean, I'm
I
making a joke, obviously, but I mean,
don't know.
isn't that somewhat
It's
redundant?
redundant. Sort of.
There are some people that question whether this is true or not, whether this is all bullshit, whether wrestler Rick Rinaldo was actually an undercover informant or not. Here's my two cents without any actual knowledge. Typically, we think when we hear these wrestler stories, they are embellishments. There are some elements of truth to it. But with this kind of story, there's no middle ground. Either it is 100% true or it is 100% false. And given the fact that this is the guy that used to wrestle as Rick Rinaldo, and like there are enough things connecting it that this, I'm convinced it's 100% true.
Yeah, and there's also they also talk later in that same article. They talk about Valentino's ties to the FBI going back even earlier, unrelated case where this guy tries to dispose of his mother's body. She was a Christian scientist and wanted to be put in a river in the Dakota, South Dakota somewhere, and the guy was going to do it, got cold feet, came back and told Ronaldo, who was his neighbor, and he like called the FBI and then they recovered the body. So there's another legitimate FBI link there.
So here's what we need to do. We need to see if Rick Rinaldo and Tank Morgan were ever in the same place at the same time. Because
Sure.
maybe the reason he got into wrestling was because the FBI wanted to see if Tank Morgan was a contract killer or not.
Yeah. And see, there's another article, and here's the problem with
Yes, here's
Rick
the
Ronaldo.
problem with a lot of things about Rick Rinaldo
So,
and the truth.
another incident where Valentino, I guess we'll call him here, who's
Sure.
also going by the name George Weston Jr., was sued for almost like $400,000 after he promised to promote a wrestling match at the Spokane Coliseum featuring Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant, where he allegedly agreed to promote the match, and then told the plaintiff in this case that the match was canceled because Hogan refused to appear. And at that point, he asked the plaintiff for more money to sue Hogan and the WWF, and then a week before that breach of contract trial was supposed to begin, Valentino tells the plaintiff that their lawyer has just died in his sleep. Then the plaintiff alleges after that, Valentino tells him that the judge in their case had been murdered and that their own lives were in danger because the heads of the WWF were linked to the mafia.
And this article is great because it actually has quotes from a spokesman for the World Wrestling Federation, Steve Planimenta, who says that he literally says none of that could have possibly happened, and that they would not have an independent, local promoter, have Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant wrestle in Spokane. So again, this just adds to the mystique because again, I truly believe that Rico. Rick, whatever we want to call him, was an informant for the FBI. But of course, a lot of times informants are, bad guys who are looking to avoid jail time by flipping. And just like what was the Steve Martin movie, My Blue Heaven, where he goes
Oh,
to
yeah.
they send him to witness protection, and he finds out that every mobster that went into witness protection was all sent to the same town. So they reform they form their own local version of the mob. So yeah, this is like, okay, you're a bad guy and you want to do good, so we're gonna let you hang out with a bunch of bad guys and keep their bad habits, and that probably carry over.
I hate to agree with the white supremacist leader of the Aryan Nation on absolutely any point at all, but he does say, like, he wonders if Valentino was an informer when he first joined the group, or if he, got in a jam with the feds and became an informant, so.
And again, even if he went in as an informant the whole way, it's probably because of something that happened earlier before he got mixed up with the Aryans. Welcome to John Plays Gordon Solie's Championship Wrestling Trivia, where each month John faces a different challenger and they play a round of Gordon Solie's Championship Wrestling Trivia. John was on a tremendous winning streak and then lost to Chad Olson a few months ago.
I
But
did.
since then, he has rebuilt his streak. He's won two in a row and now he's going for three. So let us meet your opponent for this month.
This is Sean Sparks, and I challenge my fellow Mets fan, John Boucher, to a round of Gordon Solie's wrestling trivia.
All right, a fellow Mets fan. Well, Sean, tell us a little bit about yourself. Some of our listeners might not be familiar. If you want to plug your social media platforms and, of course, the podcast you're involved with, by all means, go right ahead.
Well, I grew up in South Louisiana, so I'm a child of the Mid-South. And after UWF fizzled out, I kind of lost all interest in professional wrestling until about 10 years later, mid-90s. A couple of little happy life coincidences got me thinking about it again. And of course, around that time, internet's coming to be. I'm able to hook up with other people with similar interests in the old days of wrestling and some of the new stuff. And it just kind of snowballed from there. Currently, I am a member of the Booking the Territory podcast network's Goon JV Goon Squad, which is a collection of substitute hosts and patron content creators. Currently, I am co-hosting the Legacy Cast, which covers the current NWA product. My co-host is Half Pint Orlin Mueller.
All right, so we've got a territorial battle between booking the territory and charting the territories. John, your first thoughts.
Oh, my buddy Sparks. We're gonna start this one and end this one Ring of Honor style with a nice handshake, I'm sure.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear. And hopefully there aren't questions about Mid-South Wrestling Superdome programs, because you and I both know that Sean has a has been trying to collect all of those programs and has a good deal of them.
It does. It does.
Before we begin, let me go over the rules as I always do. Sean and John will both have 20 seconds to answer each question. I will ask Sean all four questions first while John is in the isolation chamber. Sean can ask for a hint for one of the first three questions. He must ask for the hint at the time the question is asked, and the 20-second clock will be stopped while the hint is given. You cannot ask for a hint for the fourth question. However, if you do ask for a hint, John will automatically be given the same hint for the same question and be given a hint for the fourth question. The correct answer to each question is what's written on the actual game card, and the game was released in 1987. On rare occasions, I might offer a little editorial context to clarify a question that is worded weirdly. If both Sean and John answer the same number of questions correctly, there will be a bonus question for a tiebreaker. John, any last thoughts before we send you to your isolation chamber?
If I remember correctly from what we discussed earlier, there is a deep dish pizza waiting for me in my isolation chamber this week, month rather. So, no, I'm good. I'm going to chow down and hope for the best.
Sean, John is safely sequestered in the isolation chamber. Are you ready to play Gordon Solie's Championship Wrestling Trivia?
I am as ready as I'm going to be.
All right. Question number one. Which wrestler lost a special match against then former world heavyweight boxing champion Jack Dempsey?
Ooh. I think I'm going to go to my hint.
Okay. After 6 seconds elapsed, you're going to use your hint. So I will read the hint and then you'll have 14 seconds after I'm done reading the hint. So here's the hint. To paraphrase Bon Jovi, on a steel horse he rode.
Gosh.
10 seconds.
This is going to make perfect sense when you explain it to me, but I am lost.
3 seconds. And time is up. The correct answer, Cowboy Latrell.
Okay.
Question number two. And after I read the question, I'm going to add a little clarification. The question is, what do the initials NWA represent? And my note is, what do they stand for?
That would be the National Wrestling Alliance.
That is correct. All right, you are 1 for 2 with 2 questions left. And of course, remember, you cannot ask for hints for the remaining questions, although I don't think you'll need them for the next one. Question number three, what wrestler goes by the nickname Snake?
Jake Roberts.
Jake Roberts is correct. 2 questions correct. We're up to the fourth and final question. And this is a true or false question. So true or false, the Briscoe brothers are of American Indian descent.
True.
True is correct. All right. Sean has gotten 3 out of 4 questions correctly. Now we will signal for John to come out of the isolation chamber and see how he does. All right, John, how was the pizza?
Ooh, a little heartburn.
All right, well, while you were eating, Sean was busy answering 3 questions correctly.
Was he? Okay.
He used a hint for question number one.
Okay.
So you will get a hint for that question and for question number four.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I am ready.
Question number one, and remember, I will read the hint immediately after asking the question. Which wrestler lost a special match against then former world heavyweight boxing champion Jack Dempsey? And the hint, to paraphrase Bon Jovi, on a steel horse he rode. Ten seconds. Five seconds. I need an answer. And
I don't know.
Time has expired. The answer is Cowboy Latrell.
That's a tough first question. Wow.
It is.
Wow.
Question number two.
Whew.
Now, right after I ask this question, I'm going to add in a little editorial clarification. Question number two, what do the initials NWA represent? And my editorial note is, what do they stand for?
I'm going to go with National Wrestling Alliance.
That is correct.
All right, that's got there. You never know. They might be going with
Well,
the
that's why I changed it from represent, because that the it was worried
that's
people would
right.
overthink it.
Yeah. Oh, and I will.
Question number three. What wrestler goes by the nickname Snake?
I'm assuming that we're going Jake the Snake Roberts here, or not Snake Brown. I'm gonna go Jake the Snake Roberts.
Jake the Snake Roberts is correct.
Okay.
All right, you are two for three. If you get this question right, we will go to a tiebreaker. If not, Sean Sparks gets the victory.
I'll shake his hand.
Remember, you will get a hint for immediately after I ask this question. True or false? The Briscoe brothers are of American Indian descent. Hint, there's a reason Jack's 1965 NCAA National Championship was historical.
That is true.
True is correct. All right, it's all tied up. That means we go to the bonus question, and here are the rules. Sean will have 15 seconds to answer the bonus question. And starting this month, I have made a slight change to the makeup of the question. The answer to the question is either a whole number greater than zero or a date in month, day, year format. After Sean answers, I will ask John if he thinks the correct answer is higher or lower than, or before or after, in the case of a date, Sean's response. John will have 15 seconds to respond, and if he guesses correctly, he wins. If not, Sean wins. So here's the bonus question. According to Royal Duncan and Gary Will's publication, Wrestling Title Histories, how many different non-disputed title reigns? So, for example, if they held one title two separate times and another title once, that would be three in total. So, how many different non-disputed title reigns, including all titles recognized by the promotion at the time, did the Junkyard Dog have in Mid-South Wrestling? Ten seconds left.
I'm going to say seven.
John, do you think the total number of Junkyard Dog title reigns in Mid-South was higher or lower than seven? Five seconds. I need an answer.
Let me go higher.
The correct answer, 14. John Boucher.
By the skin of my
By
teeth.
the skin of your teeth. Do your
Oh.
teeth have skin?
After that pizza,
After
yes.
that one, they do. You probably were biting your lip the whole time.
Oh,
Whoo!
baby.
Cutting it close, but John
Oh.
comes through with a last nanosecond
Oh.
victory.
What a match.
Ooh, that was a tough one. Sean also got the first question incorrect.
Man.
Good
Oh,
challenge
man.
from Sean Sparks.
Yeah, wow. I'm oh wow, yeah, that was good. Good. And I'm a virtual handshake to Sparks for that
Yes,
match.
they will adhere to the code of honor, which
Yeah,
is
absolutely.
wonderful to see. Sparks,
Yes.
someone we've talked to many times over the years in our work, particularly
Good
with
buddy.
Leroy McGurk territory and the Mid-South years as well.
Great guy.
So yeah, we're going to move from Sparks to a gladiator, although both of you were gladiators
Yes.
in that trivia challenge. But another man who was a gladiator in the ring for many years was Ricky Hunter. And as we always do every month, John curates some footage of what's available on YouTube of Ricky Hunter in action. So you've got, I believe it's five clips of Ricky Hunter in action. So go over what each of them are and then pick one of them to just give a little more info about.
Yeah, basically try to get a good cross section of his career from what's out here. I've got Ricky Hunter, Mr. Saito, Cow Palace 74, Ricky Hunter versus Antonio Inoki, August 76 in Brazil. Ricky Hunter versus Adrian Adonis, Portland, March of 79. Ricky Hunter versus Wayne Bridges, World of Sport 81. And lastly, the Islanders versus Rick Hunter and Omar Atlas, WWF Superstars 1988. I guess I'll talk about Ricky Hunter versus Inoki. This is August 14th, 1976, New Japan. The main reason I chose this one is because it's just 2 months after the Ali versus Inoki match.
I was going to say that was right after.
Yeah, and what I love about this is the first thing Ricky Hunter does is try to land kicks on Inoki's legs. Which I thought just is so cool. Ricky Hunter sells like a champ for Inoki here. It looks like these strikes from Inoki are just destroying him. And it's Inoki, so the stuff is really laid in, as is the grappling and the cross faces and everything. Look, super, super snug here. Like if you told me they just went into this match, just a 5 minute match, they went in here knowing the finish, like, hey, let's go 5 minutes, and the rest was like a friendly shoot, I would believe you. They do a great job of making this look like a real athletic contest where these guys are just really, really working each other over, and it's great for what it is, essentially just like a 5 minute squash, but it's really good. Highly recommend this one.
Yeah, and the other matches, as you mentioned, are a good cross section of his career going from 1974 to 1988, all in different places. I mean, 1979, Ricky Hunter versus Adrian Adonis, that's something. There's not a lot of early Adonis footage out there.
No, and this, and I know we're just going to talk about one, but really quickly, this is
Go.
cool because, I thought this would be cool because Adonis has like a legit sort of amateur background, and Hunter has great in-ring ability, and it's a babyface versus babyface match because Adonis is a babyface here. So it's interesting seeing Adonis work as a babyface because in this match, at least, he's not taking those big bumps that he does when he's a heel. He's just not leaving his feet aside from taking an arm drag or getting a headlock takeover. But this is like right up my alley. So, and if you like that kind of like baby face versus baby face scientific stuff, this is great.
Yeah, so you can see Hunter at different times in different roles, in different places on our YouTube channel. Just search for Charting the Territories on YouTube. Ricky Hunter was born Charles Sprott in 1936 in Winnipeg. So that match in 1988, he's at least 51 years old. He's either 51 or 52 at that point. So that's a pretty long career. His father passed away when he was just a child. And then he dropped out of high school in 11th grade and began to dabble in many sports before meeting George Gordienko, Gordon Nelson, and Ole Olsen at the YMCA. Olsen got him a job with the fire department while Ricky was training to be a wrestler. He spent his first few years wrestling in Canada before coming to the Pacific Northwest for the first time in 1962. And then he spent a good almost 20 years working across North America and Canada and the US, in some places working as Ricky Hunter, and in others under a mask as the Gladiator, or on some occasions as the Super Gladiator. And in Amarillo in 1971, he wrestled as the Spartan, though he would be unmasked during that run, including once in El Paso by Dory Funk Sr. And that was covered in the May 11th, 1971 edition of the El Paso Times. So we'll post that article on Twitter at Al Getz Wrestling. We'll use the hashtag CTTAUG24. Also a photo of him as the Super Gladiator, and he's wearing a shirt, tie, and jacket, but he's got the mask on as the Super Gladiator. And this is from
Love that.
July 1973 in the Columbus Ledger. This would have been when he was working for Ann Gunkel's All South. There was another gladiator on the program, and that was the Golden Gladiator, who was Ron Hill. And then while working for Gunkel, Ricky Hunter was alleged to have been involved in an incident in the WTBS, or I think it was still WTCG,
Yeah, at the time.
parking lot with Jack Briscoe. So, John, talk a little bit about Ricky Hunter versus Jack Briscoe.
And the article basically says that, Sprott alleges that Briscoe called him names in the parking lot, and the name calling occurred in a hearing distance of a number of wrestling fans who were waiting to see the TV taping. So at this point, they would both promotions were doing their TV tapings at the TV studio. So there was always this sort of
not just at the same TV studio, but literally one after the other. Not you know, several hours later. Literally as the NWA crew was leaving, Gunkel's crew was coming in. So there was no way to avoid these types of incidences.
So he sued Briscoe for $75,000 for slander and harassment, plus any business losses. So I'm not sure exactly what was said, and there's actually no record of it, this lawsuit. I'm assuming it was whatever was just thrown out, because there's no record of anything else happening with it anywhere. And not surprisingly, there's no mention of the incident in Jack Briscoe's book. But Briscoe does sort of like run Hunter down a little bit in his book, sort of mocks him, calls him like the professor in a derisive way, because he would just talk about stuff he thought he knew all the time. But there is a mention of it, also not surprisingly, also
right,
in Jim Wilson's Chokehold book, where he talks
and about there's a couple of pages where he talks about what happened to all the wrestlers that chose to work for Gunkel during the split, which, let's be clear, at the time was the Georgia crew. Pretty much all of them sided with Gunkel, the opposition, with the exception of Bob Armstrong and one of the Oates brothers. And I think the other Oates brother only worked for Ann for a short period of time before going back to the NWA. And I think Daryl Cochran, who was Bob Armstrong's friend. Aside from them, the whole crew left. So Jim Wilson, and again, Jim is one of those, take it with a grain of salt. Although he does, you know, a lot of what he says is true. It's just, he's one of the few that at the time was willing to speak out against the NWA, but he sort of runs down alleged incidents that occurred to pretty much everybody that sided with Ann Gunkel at first. Of course, after the first couple of months, a good number of Gunkel's crew did leave and go back to, and not to the NWA Georgia, but to another NWA affiliated promotion. So there was buyer's remorse, I guess, if that's the right term, for several of the wrestlers, not long after jumping ship. But again, whether Wilson's claims are true or not, you'll have to read what I post on Twitter to determine for yourself.
Yes.
We'll also post a link to an interview from 2006 with Ricky Hunter from Dutch Savage's old website. John, was there one interesting thing from this interview that you wanted to point out?
The thing that stuck out to me was they asked him about working for Shire, and he says that they developed the Gladiator in California, and it was a Shire idea, which timeline wise doesn't make sense, but I guess he could have developed it and say, hey, here, run with this. But I've always heard that Eddie Graham liked Ricky Hunter because he, you know, I don't want to call him a shooter, but he had amateur ability and could handle himself in the ring, which, you know, Eddie Graham liked, but he thought he lacked, you know, the charisma or the fire, and he thought the mask would help him get over, which it did.
Yeah, and Graham sure loved his mask wrestlers.
He did.
In the mid to late 60s and early 70s. So, again, could just be a case of Ricky misremembering, or there could be just a partial truth.
He really likes Roy Shire, which is so interesting, because you hear so many guys who are not big fans of Shire at all, but he loved working for Roy Shire. You know, and it's his career, if I could talk about that for Shire, is really interesting. Just because he's at this weird position, because he's not definitely not a top guy. He's almost in sort of like that Jay Strongbow sort of role, working both as a heel and a babyface, where he's sort of like the gatekeeper guy. Like if there's a guy who's coming to him to have a main event program with one of the top guys, Ricky Hunter would be the guy before the guy,
right?
Like, and he talks about how he learned a lot about not just his in-ring work, had him prove that there, but also psychology working both ways and understanding what his role was, what he needed to do, there at that point. And clearly, thinking years later, this is where he, one of the places he worked with Pat Patterson, when Pat Patterson was thinking of guys he needed for, TV enhancement. And he's like, oh, the Hunter, here's a guy who knows his role, knows what to do, and boom, brought him in.
There was a funny question and answer from that interview. So this was 2006. So Ricky Hunter is asked, "What do you think of the current state of professional wrestling?" And his response, "I am very disappointed. It shows me nothing."
There you go.
There's also an obituary on Slam Wrestling. Of course, they always do great work with their obituaries. I'll mention that during one of his stops in this obituary, he mentions that during one of his stops in Hawaii over the years, he met a school teacher named Sherry Zerbel or Zerbel. And the two were married for 34 years until Ricky's passing. So here, this month, we're talking about Hawaii on the podcast and Ricky Hunter in Hawaii. And that is where he met his wife
Oh,
in
that's sweet.
Hawaii.
Also, they mentioned, I didn't know he was in this movie, but I've seen the movie years ago, and it's mentioned in the Slam obituary. He was in Moonrunners, which I got to do a rewatch of this. Have you ever seen Moonrunners?
I don't know that I have.
It's from 73. I don't know if I'd call it like a Dukes of Hazzard prequel per se, but it's sort of like a precursor to the Dukes of Hazzard, and there's a lot of the same characters. There's an Uncle Jesse, Cooter, Sheriff Roscoe P. Coltrane. Like if you like the Dukes of Hazzard and 70s car chases, this is worth wasting a rainy afternoon or a lazy weekend night. It's not the Milagro Beanfield War or anything like that, cinema, but it's fun if that's what you want. Waylon Jennings like narrates it, and like Dukes of Hazzard, Chips and the Hulk were all my favorite TV shows as a kid. So this movie really
Has a little bit
appeals to
of
me.
all those
Yeah.
shows.
And Ricky Hunter plays a loudmouth in a bar. And if I recall correctly, he's not the only wrestler. Dick Steinborn also plays an annoying barfly. And Happy Humphrey also makes an appearance. And this was probably all during the Georgia All South Gunkles time, because
Yeah.
they were all
Yeah.
working
They
for
were
Gunkle.
all, yep, they were all in the Gunkle promotion. So, for more on Hawaii in 1971, you can check out A Year in the Life at chartingtheterritories.com. There's a profile I wrote, which is titled "A Gentleman, the Gentleman and the Mad Dog," because it talks about Ed Francis, who was billed as Gentleman Ed Francis when he was a full-time wrestler, starting 50th State Big Time Wrestling in Hawaii after purchasing the promotion from Al Karasik in 1961, and how 1971, as I mentioned earlier, the main character was Mad Dog Maine. So we talk about his run in the territory in 1971. When you look at the biggest feuds in Hawaii for the year, since we only have 61 house shows and 50 plus of them are from Honolulu, we're really looking at which matches happened the most different times in Honolulu. And there were four matches that happened three times in Honolulu, and they are Bearcat Wright versus Mad Dog Maine, Gene Kaniski versus Sam Steamboat, Billy Robinson versus Curtis Iakea, and Ed Francis coming out of retirement, so to speak, to take on Mad Dog Maine, which happens at the end of the year. So you can follow along with that. We also list all the matches of those four feuds and the finishes of each match. You can see how the feud progresses. But when you look at Mad Dog Maine, we also have a chart that shows you chronologically who he's wrestling against the most and when he holds the different titles. Because he, in late February, within a 3-day span, he won the Hawaiian tag team titles with Ripper Collins, and he won the Hawaiian heavyweight title by himself. So less than 2 months into his run, he's got two titles, one singles and one tag. And you can literally see how his character arc, and I hate using that term for pro wrestlers, but it really is accurate. You can see how he developed as a wrestler. At first, he is teaming with Collins and he's feuding with Billy Robinson and Frankie Lane, as well as having singles matches against Frankie Lane. Then, as you move to later in the year, he starts having matches against Bearcat Wright. When his team with Ripper Collins loses the tag team titles, they end up having a very brief heel versus heel feud where they have two matches. And I think Maine wins a loser leave town match and Ripper Collins goes back to Portland, I want to say, but I could be wrong. The feud with Bearcat ends up in a loser paints the, sorry, winner paints the loser either black or white. So if Bearcat, you know, so if Bearcat lost, he'd have been painted white. If and if Moondog lost, he'd be painted black. Thankfully, Moondog lost that one. And then, as I mentioned earlier, he ends his year-long run here by feuding with Ed Francis, who comes out of retirement to beat Maine to win the Hawaiian heavyweight title. But they keep Maine strong by putting him into a tag team with Sweet Daddy Siki, and they win the Hawaiian tag team titles right as Francis wins the singles title. So this is how territories kept guys afloat. They, you know, they're going to have to lose the title at some point, but if their run isn't done yet, they still find something else for them to do. And so by putting Maine in another tag team, this time with Sweet Daddy Siki, that gives him something new to work out for the next few months. Unfortunately, something happens outside of the ring in Hawaii in 1971 that spells the beginning of the end for the promotion as a regular territory. And that is the sale of the Civic Auditorium, which was their primary weekly venue. They would, several times a year, they would run a larger venue, the Honolulu International Center. But by and large, the weekly venue was the Civic Auditorium. But it was sold in late 1971, and the new owners planned to shut down the venue in the spring of 1972. So all of a sudden, Ed Francis, who has built Hawaii up into a, from all accounts, very profitable territory, regardless of whether they were running two shows a week or six, who knows how many they were actually running, but they were doing very good business. They had wrestlers, you know, stopping and going on their way to or from Hawaii. They had wrestlers who would move and live on the island for several months. Mad Dog Maine, he was a regular here in 71 and early 72, and he's almost certainly living on the island because they're not flying in back from Portland each and every week, and he was here, you know, every single week. So you know, they're making enough money for guys to relocate there. Of course, you know, being stuck in Hawaii, only wrestling a couple of times a week is probably still a pretty good gig.
Yeah.
So even if they weren't getting full-time work and even if the pay wasn't amazing, still there are worse places to be poor.
Yeah.
After the Civic Auditorium shuts down, they have to run the Honolulu International Center whenever they can. Thus, they lose the full-timers that live on the island. And he has to make a deal with Vern Gagne to pretty much fly a crew in from the AWA every time they have a show, which also helps Vern because Vern isn't running six, seven nights a week to begin with in his area because the towns are so spread out. So this gives his whole crew an extra day of work every few weeks, thus keeping them happy enough to stay working for Vern and making enough money to do it. So again, it's something that has absolutely nothing to do with wrestling that begins the downfall of a territory that, you know, was really doing gangbuster business in the 70s. We only have one attendance figure from 1971, and that's an August 4th show, which was headlined by Maine versus Ripper Collins, as well as Bearcat Wright teaming with Pedro Morales against Gene Kaniski and the Sheik. And that drew 8,000 fans to the Honolulu International Center. Speaking of Pedro, this is also the only territory in 1971 that had the reigning NWA World Heavyweight Champion come in, the reigning AWA World Heavyweight Champion come in, and the reigning WWWF Heavyweight World Heavyweight Champion come in. Because Dory, Vern, and Pedro all wrestled in Hawaii in 1971 while they were world champions of their respective promotions.
Wow.
So that pretty much wraps things up about Hawaii in 1971 in the early 70s. So from a territory on the decline in the early 70s to one that was expanding, next month we will look at the territory that probably ran more house shows than anyone else at the time, covering all of Tennessee, the northern half of Alabama, and parts of four other states. It was a tag team heavy territory. It was also a masked wrestler heavy territory with more masked heels than Tojo Yamamoto could shake his wooden shoe at. Of course, we're talking about the Gulas Welch territory, and we will look at it next month on the podcast. Now, before we go, we always end every month's podcast with a segment called This Month I Learned, where both John and I share one new thing we learned during the month. So, John, what did you learn this month?
Seeing as we were in Waterloo there, I've had Dan Gable on the brain for the last month or so. And one thing I've always wondered about, when you read about Dan Gable and all his accolades, largely considered to be one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, is, he's always referred to as a two-time NCAA Division I champion. Now, we all know that he lost once, to Larry Owings. But hypothetically, if he had beaten Larry Owings, why would he have only been a three-time champ, not a four-time champ? Always wondered about that. So this month, I just figure out why, and I learned this month that the NCAA would not allow freshmen to play varsity sports, as there is a widely held belief that freshmen were not physically ready to compete against upperclassmen. This is not just true in wrestling, other sports as well. Bill Walton and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar only had 3 years of varsity basketball. Pistol Pete Maravich only played 3 years at LSU, still set the career scoring record without a 3-point line or a shot clock. What's even more interesting is that in 1968, the NCAA began to allow freshmen to play on varsity teams on all sports except football and basketball. And Dan Gable's freshman year was 1967. So if he had been born 1 year later, he may have had the opportunity to become a four-time NCAA Division I champion.
And he probably would have.
Yeah, who knows?
This month I learned was something I alluded to earlier. There was a wrestler in Hawaii in 1971 by the name of Bill Steele, also sometimes billed as the Skull. And up until now, no one had linked him to anybody else. Nobody knew who this wrestler was, if he worked under another name, or if he was just some random guy. But he's here in Hawaii for about 3 months. So with the help of Chris Knights from WrestlingData.com, this month I learned that Bill Steele was the wrestler better known as Billy Red Cloud. And how we found this out, the first thing we did was we looked at the dates that Bill Steele was confirmed to be in Hawaii, and he's wrestling regularly for about 3 months in May, June, and July. And Chris is an editor for WrestlingData.com, and he has a few tricks where what he can do is he can do a search for any wrestler who was active before May of 1971 and after July of 1971 for whom there are no confirmed records, but from in the 3 month period that this person was in Hawaii. So we look, literally, doing some magic tricks, the database was able to find any wrestler who had no matches in that 3 month period, but was a active wrestler both before and after. And there were two people that were possibilities, one of whom was Billy Red Cloud. And when we compared the picture in the newspaper articles of Bill Steele, two pictures online of Billy Red Cloud, it is absolutely positively 100% a
Wow.
match.
Cool.
So yet another wrestling history mystery solved. What makes it even more interesting is that as Billy Red Cloud, he wrestled in Hawaii in 1965. And several years later, when he came back to the island, for whatever reason, they decided not to bill him as Native American Billy Red Cloud, but instead as Bill the Skull Steele. And again, this might be one of the situations where the territory was just babyface heavy at the time, and they needed somebody to be a heel for a few months to sort of even things out. And since he had a shaved head, they said, okay, you're now the Skull Bill Steele.
Wow. Didn't he also do a what was it, Killer Kane? Was that one of his gimmicks somewhere? I forget. Is that the same Billy Red Cloud or a different?
Yes, that was in 1969 in Arizona. He was
Ah, okay.
Killer Kane.
Killer Kane.
Yes, the same wrestler. That was, yeah, he was also, so he's Billy Red Cloud. In some places, he was Bobby Red Cloud. In one place, he was Killer Kane. And in one place, he was the Skull Bill Steele. And prior to all that, he spent about 9 or so years working as Bill Wright. which is believed to be his real name.
Okay.
So slowly but surely, we're filling in the gaps of all these wrestlers and completing their career records and linking up all their different aliases. So that does it for this month's episode of Charting the Territories. I want to thank all our listeners. Also, don't forget my latest and book, the Heart of America / Central States Wrestling Almanac for covering the years 1974 to 1976. Is available worldwide on Amazon, or you can get autographed copies at chartingtheterritories.com. Also, later this month, you can buy them in Las Vegas, Nevada at the Cauliflower Alley Club Reunion, where I will have a table set up in the hospitality suite.
Ooh, baby.
Yes. So looking forward to going to my second Cauliflower Alley Club Reunion. I also got the chance to speak with Brian Blair while in Waterloo. We definitely left the door open for some more conversations because I really want to let the CAC know about my work and what I do and the different approach that we take to wrestling history than many other great historians. Of course, I also want to once again thank Stephen Johnson and Tom Burke for welcoming me into their club in person, but also all the other former winners who have talked, who have reached out to me over the last several months, including Greg Oliver and Mark James and a couple of other names who I am unintentionally forgetting. But it was really great to hear from all the former award winners who reached out to say congrats or to say even just to say hi. It was really cool. And I had a wonderful time in Waterloo, and I will be there for years to come I'm concerned.
Me too.
As will John. So remember, now you've got to bring a friend next year, and I've got to bring a different friend.
Oh, wow.
We got to keep this thing growing.
Yeah, it's a big crowd. I mean, we didn't mention that. I think this was the highest. It was the biggest.
It was the biggest by a lot. I think last year they had set the record, and it was somewhere around 180 or maybe even a little less than that. And this year it was over 220 by the time all was said and done.
A lot of freaking da.
Yeah, so they smashed the record. So that was really great to see. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter at Al Getz Wrestling, Al Getz Wrestling. Like I mentioned, I will be in Vegas for Cauliflower Alley Club. And that's about all I've got going on. John, have you been working on anything?
No, I mean, while you're in Vegas, I'll be on my personal vacation, not in Vegas. So that's all.
I like that you're not telling me where you're going to be, and in case you're afraid I would just show up and say, "Hey, let's hang out."
No, I'm gonna be out on Long Island, out on the beach.
Okay, I've been on the beach on Long Island many a time in my younger days. I also want to thank our friend Sean Sparks for being this month's challenger on Gordon Solie's Championship Wrestling Trivia. Be sure to check out the Booking the Territory, the unprofessional wrestling podcast. Classic wrestling recaps and ridiculousness are their thing.
Lots of ridiculous.
And for more information, you can go to patreon.com/bookingtheterritory. The Charting the Territories podcast comes out on the second Thursday of the month. To be the first to know when new episodes are available, subscribe now wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at chartingtheterritories.com. John, thanks so much for joining me in Waterloo and joining me this month on the podcast. Enjoy your vacation on Long Island. Don't eat too many deep dish pizzas, and I'll see you in September.
September menfo, baby.